Now, ladies and gentlemen, the latest war news as brought to you by staff reporters both at home and abroad. And the first news today comes from London, England.
This is Robert St. John in London. We have two indications today of how the British are helping the Russians. The Admiralty announces that a British minesweeper in the Arctic has shot down a Nazi plane as it was attacking a Soviet ship. And it was officially announced that those attacks on the Prince Eugen and the Tirpitz have probably broken up concentrations of Nazi ships in Norwegian waters. This at least temporarily clears the route to Russia. Correspondents with British ships which hammered the Italian island of Rhodes in the Mediterranean say that they hurled 20 tons of shells into the target in 20 minutes, a smashing blow. Today it was said officially here that the Chinese and the British have not yet joined forces in Burma. London's financial paper tells us today that Vickers, the big steel and munitions company, has just issued its 1941 statement. Profit for the year amounted to about $4 million. That's a drop from 1940, but the dividend will still be maintained at 10% for the sixth consecutive year. In the same issue of the paper, there's a letter from a reader who says, "Do we really need the bribe of high wages and salaries to persuade us to the total effort? I suggest that the profit incentive is not relevant to total war." A year ago, Britain's firemen saved England. By day and by night, they fought flames which often threatened to destroy whole cities. They risked their lives not only from falling walls, but from bombs, because there's no better target for a Nazi plane than a burning building. But this year, they've just been standing by, waiting for air raid fires which haven't materialized. And now, like everyone else in England, they want to get to work to help in the great spring war effort. There are 100,000 of them. They've figured out a scheme. They want to turn their 20,000 fire stations into miniature factories, factories which would keep working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Many of the firemen are skilled engineers. They figure they could make munitions or airplane parts while they're standing by. They've appealed to the Prime Minister himself to help them find a way to do useful work instead of just polishing brass. Now here are today's signs of the times in England. The government has cut our clothing allowance by 25%. Instead of 5.5 coupons a month, we'll get about 4, enough to buy 2 pairs of silk stockings a month and nothing more. Now we can expect to see more and more British women in slacks, because you don't have to wear stockings with slacks. The Ministry of Agriculture has told people with greenhouses on their private estates that this year they must raise tomatoes instead of rare flowers. The Ministry of Food may soon forbid public banquets. Because of the scarcity of soap, public restaurants may soon be ordered to limit each guest to one knife and one fork for the whole meal. A banana has just sold here for $10 and a bottle of whiskey for $500. It happened at a public auction. The money goes to buy battleships for Britain. And now, this is Robert St. John in London, returning you to New York.
Now, here in the New York newsroom, we have news of storms in the United States. At least 115 persons are dead in the wake of a series of tornadoes which swept through 6 southern and midwestern states yesterday. Hundreds more are injured, and the final count is not yet in. Property damage, from early estimates, has put at several millions of dollars. Countless houses and barns have been leveled. Livestock lies dead throughout the area. Roads were blocked by fallen trees, and telephone and telegraph lines are down. The Red Cross and relief agencies are caring for thousands of the homeless. Mississippi was hardest hit. Tennessee, Kentucky, Indiana, Illinois, and Missouri also were affected. And from Moscow this morning comes word that the Moscow radio says that the German 16th Army, trapped at Staraya Russa, has been given a particularly grave setback. Now, that's how it describes the Nazi loss of an important point of resistance in heavy fighting below Leningrad. Frontline dispatches identify the point only as N, but it's situated on the summit of a commanding height. The Soviet Information Bureau announces the destruction of 215 German planes to only 57 Russian losses in the period from March the 8th to the 14th for a victory ratio of nearly 4-1. And dispatches of Nazis surrendering in ever greater numbers in the Ukraine, where Red Marshal Timoshenko is storming the great city of Kharkov, are coming through. Now, this would indicate that new advances against the Nazi-held Pittsburgh of the Ukraine, Kharkov, with its 800,000 Russian inhabitants. Earlier dispatches from Stockholm told of Russian forces cutting off reserve 140 miles north of Moscow and a major base of German operations against the entire front below Leningrad. And Red Army columns were also said to be closing in on the large city of Kursk, just above Kharkov. And Russian parachute troops were said to have established themselves behind Nazi lines on the front at Smolensk. And Moscow says that 215 German planes were destroyed last week against a Russian loss of 57. And now let's get a picture of the Far East fighting from the newsroom in San Francisco.
From our San Francisco newsroom, we bring you the latest reports of the Far East. Lieutenant General Harold Alexander, new commander-in-chief in Burma, said today that the Imperial forces have worked out new strategic and tactical plans. Plans in which they have started stabbing at the Japanese in vigorous local offensive actions. He said the Japanese appear to be driving first toward the Tharawadi oil fields and Prome, 150 miles north-northwest of Rangoon, and secondly up the Satang River Valley and the Rangoon-Mandalay Railroad in an attempt to capture Mandalay and cut communications between Lower and Upper Burma. Alexander said the Japanese are seeking oil, which they need badly after finding oil fields in the Netherlands East Indies destroyed in the Dutch scorched earth destruction. Imperial troops are now in contact with the enemy in the Shwegian area, 100 miles northeast of Rangoon, along the Satang River and the railroad to Mandalay. In one of the first of their new offensive stabs, the Imperial forces have retaken Shwegin on the Japanese side of the river, 20 miles to the west on the railroad. At the west side of the front, there is no real contact with the Japanese south of Tharawadi, and only patrol actions are in progress at the moment. Alexander said recent British reverses in Burma were due partly to over-mechanization of frontline forces, which limited defensive operations to roads, while the Japanese used tracks and jungle paths to move by night through the forests, where airplanes could not spot them and tanks could not operate. Alexander frankly admitted Japanese successes against Imperial troops who had not been trained in jungle warfare. However, he said British troops had fought magnificently and named the Duke of Wellington's regiment, the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry, the West Yorkshire Regiment, the Gloucestershire Regiment, and the Tank Corps as having fought gallant actions. Of the Chinese forces who have now joined their line with that of the Imperials in Burma, Alexander said that their discipline is excellent and they have very sound ideas about how to deal with the Japanese. After reviewing the mistakes the Imperials had made by sticking to roads while the Japanese avoided them, he said that the Imperial forces are now far enough advanced in jungle warfare training to oppose Japanese infiltration. Despite the loss of Rangoon, he said, the battle for Burma has not yet begun. He said only 2 months remain for large-scale operations because of weather conditions, and said that in spite of immense difficulties, he was optimistic regarding the future. He said it had been found impossible to hold Rangoon against a siege and that it had been abandoned rather than risk disaster in leaving nothing between the Japanese and the oil fields of central Burma. In the Southwest Pacific, Allied commanders are seeking to mass in Australia a great defensive and offensive force, it was understood today, as Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson announced at Washington the arrival of United States forces on the Australian continent. Well-informed sources say it is the intention of the Allied commands first to stop the Japanese when they attack Australia and then to move out to regain the rich territories which the Japanese have taken and win the war. Australians asserted on the basis of latest developments that only the failure of civil as well as military cooperation between the United States and Australia can lead to the conquest of Australia. Authoritative opinion is that the Japanese will find it difficult to take Australia. They will be facing white troops in a white man's country instead of small white forces in colonies teeming with natives. The British, Australian, and Dutch troops, whom the Japanese faced elsewhere, were better man for man. They will be facing larger forces than they have faced before, with more equipment, and the men they face will be trained in latest Japanese tactics. Since the Pacific War started, and especially since the disaster of Singapore, Australian Army discipline and training have been tightened. The Army has been brought to full strength, and all able-bodied men have been made liable to service. It is the opinion here that Japan must attack Australia in order to ensure that it is cut off from the supplies and manpower of the United States. Japanese tactics have by now been well demonstrated. They will prove difficult in Australia. It is like an ocean with three islands in it, the northwestern, southwestern, and southeastern corners, separated by 500,000 square miles of dry country. The Japanese have resumed aerial attacks on the northwest corner, the Darwin-Wyndham-Broome area. And that's the news from the Far East, from the newsroom in San Francisco. We take you now across the continent to our newsroom in Washington.
Good morning. Claude Mahoney speaking from Washington. There are two bills on the Hill now that would affect labor drastically, and both of them are brewing up their own little fights. Secretary Perkins filed her opposition to the Reid bill to suspend the 40-hour week for the duration. We don't know what was in her report, but Senator Thomas of Utah, chairman of the Labor Committee, said of course it was adverse. Then the other bill is much sharper. It was put in by Representative Smith of Virginia and Representative Vinson of Georgia, and would not only suspend the 40-hour week for the duration, but would abolish overtime, outlaw closed shops, and limit profits to 6%. In order to get around the Labor Committee, which probably would be a little cool to a bill that strong, it applies only to naval construction work and thus goes into the Naval Committee, of which Vinson is chairman. He says hearings will start this week and the bill will be on the floor soon. Of course, when it got out, it could be amended to include all fields of labor, not only just the naval. Representative Mary Norton of New Jersey, chairman of the Labor Committee, sums up her opinion of that bill by saying, all these people are trying to do is to use the war to scuttle the wage hour law and deprive labor of its rights. The only new aspect of the selective service drawing that I can find this morning is that the fact that the capsules in which the numbers are placed are going to be green tonight, green in honor of St. Patrick's Day. The drawing will begin in the big departmental auditorium on Constitution Avenue at 6 o'clock with a short talk by General Hershey opening the show. The actual pulling of the first number will come about 6:15 when Secretary Stimson sticks his hand into the goldfish bowl and brings out the number. He'll be blindfolded, of course, and will be fishing entirely in the dark. Other dignitaries will follow him, and finally the drawing will settle down to a steady all-night job, with workers from Selective Service Headquarters pulling the capsules. And with this drawing, the men of 20 years and those of 36 to 44 will be assigned numbers for possible induction. The House and the Senate both are hot on the trail of Robert R. Guthrie to find out about his charges that differences of opinion within the textile division of the War Production Board forced his retirement in discouragement. Mr. Guthrie has been asked to come before a special House subcommittee, and on the other side, Senator Truman's Defense Investigating Committee also is planning to call him. In the meantime, Donald Nelson, the production boss, is making his own investigation. Not much new today on the tremendously important bill to establish a Woman's Auxiliary Army Corps, but the experts on Capitol Hill say it will go right through. It would provide thousands of $21 a month women for use in a variety of war work, for use almost anywhere that would release a man for combat duty. And interestingly enough, right here in Washington, they're starting a school for filling station operators, teaching those operators how to teach you and me to take care of our automobile tires and, if possible, to make those tires last 3 years. And that's the news from Washington at this time.
That's the latest news of the world. You've heard Robert St. John from London, Claude Mahoney from Washington, and reports by the newsrooms in San Francisco and New York. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station.
This program came to you from New York. This is the National Broadcasting Company.